Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places. Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Hey there, everyone, and welcome to Forward Thinking, the podcast that looks at the future and says, here's a little story I've got to tell about three bad podcasters you know so well. I'm Jonathan Strickland.
I'm Lauren Vogelbaum.
And I'm Joe McCormick.
And, You don't dig the Beastie Boys there, Lauren?
No, I do. That was lovely.
Thank you. Thank you. And we want to talk a little bit more about big data. You know, we talked about
data.
Big data. It's okay. I'm going to use both pronunciations.
Data.
Okay, fair enough. So big info. Big data, because we are talking about computer information here.
And not the Android from Star Trek.
Yeah, just get that out of the way. So we wanted to talk more about applications, what different organizations, companies, governments are using big data for, what they're mining out of this huge amount of information that we are generating every day. Now, you may remember in our last podcast, we said that we're generating about 2.5 quintillion bytes of information per day, and not just humans, but, you know, sensors, things that are indirectly.
Internet of things.
Yeah, Internet of things, stuff that's connected to the Internet that we're not directly inputting data into.
And for those of us who missed the last podcast, what's the difference between this paradigm of big data and just, say, a lot of data?
Big data, we're talking huge, huge, enormous amounts of information. When we're talking 2.5 quintillion bytes, that's half of all the spoken words that humans have uttered since the dawn of language. So we're talking about, in 2 days, you generate as much information as all the words we've ever spoken ever, mm-hmm, of all the people.
So there's this issue of volume, but also these characteristics we talked about last time,
yeah,
like velocity,
yes,
and variety. So it's not just the amount of data, but it's interacting
exactly
extremely fast.
We're gathering it at an incredible pace. I mean, you're gathering data at an unprecedented pace.
And it's rich and intense and everywhere.
Yeah, and it's all different types of information. And also, there's a fourth V that we can mention, which is
veracity,
which is the quality of the information.
Truthiness.
Yeah, yeah. There you go. We're gonna tell you some strategeries that people use with big data.
It does mean truthiness. I mean, it means that the data is essentially high quality.
Right, yeah. Veracity is really kind of their way of saying how good is your information. And sometimes you don't know how good your information is because, again, you've got a lot of it. Until you analyze it, you don't really know if there's anything useful there. IBM is in the business of leveraging big data and helping other companies leverage it. And they say very clearly on their website and in their white papers that the important part here is that you have to figure out what your goal is before you start just looking at big data and saying, we need to be part of this. Because whatever your goal is, that's going to end up informing your approach to using that information in a way that makes sense. Otherwise, you're just talking about an enormous resource that may not be directly useful to you. You're just kind of looking at it and thinking, I want to make use of that information. It's too big a problem for me to even get a grasp on how I want to use it. So you can't just run at it and say, give me some ones and zeros, I'm going to make magic happen. You have to have a plan in place first.
But I bet a lot of really clever people have figured out really cool stuff to do with this information.
Sure. In the last podcast, we talked a little bit about traffic analysis, which was a very kind of, it's an easy to understand application of big data, right? So let me give you an example using Google's approach. So the way Google would generate traffic on Google Maps, if you were using Google Maps on a mobile device and you wanted to try and get from point A to point B and you wanted traffic to be part of that equation, that route, then what it would do is it would start looking at information of other Google users. There are other systems that use this, the Dash system, which doesn't really exist anymore, but it used a very similar approach where it would send anonymous data about vehicles that were moving through a particular region and the speed at which they were moving. It was just sampling the vehicle's
via GPS.
Yeah, sampling the vehicle's location. It would get the GPS coordinates, and it would just sample it over a certain amount of time and derive how fast that vehicle was moving down the street based upon the information, right? Saying, okay, well, it was at this point at this time, and then it was at this other point a little bit later, and this other point a little bit later. Therefore, that means traffic is moving at this speed down this particular street. And then it extrapolates that, sends it out to everyone so that you know which routes have the heaviest traffic.
Right.
Now,
That's smart.
Yeah. It's a very simple approach to big data in the sense that it's just taking real-time information, analyzing it, and sending the results back very quickly. It's not storing information. It's not trying to be transformative with the information. It's just trying to make sense of all these different pieces of information that are coming in and then making it meaningful to the people who are using the service. So that's one example, but that's just one. You can actually see some pretty interesting patterns when you get huge amounts of information. You can see patterns where you might have thought there was just chaos before. So you can look at a system that you might say, well, from the outset, it just looks like stuff is happening. But now when I see all this information and it's broken down like this, I can actually see trends where before I just saw stuff. So education is a good example of this. So let's say you're a teacher,
mm-hmm.
and you're teaching a class, and you have your class is submitting schoolwork into a system that can then analyze the schoolwork. So you're grading the kids. You might actually just be inserting the grades into the system. In fact, it may not have any connection with the kids directly at all. You might just be the teacher in the system. The system would be able to, if you're using a very sophisticated approach, be able to start detecting trends in each individual student's progress. So you might be able to say, oh, while student A isn't failing, the trend indicates that the student is beginning to struggle. So I need to adjust my way of reaching this student so that I'm not leaving the student without any support.
Oh, I wonder. So would that involve comparing little signals with millions of other students? Like if we've seen that when these things start to happen statistically, that means like we're heading towards failure.
It would mean that. It would also mean that on a larger level, you might see that an entire classroom is having some issues, which would tell the teacher, I need to change my approach. Mm-hmm. This concept that I've tried to teach, obviously, this has not worked out. So I need to find a new way of getting this across in a way that makes sense to my students.
Or perhaps help an entire school system figure out how to grade and test better.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know how if you take a survey, and your survey has just 100 people in it, well, it's probably not very representative of the entire population, but
you can play Family Feud.
Right. If you have 1,000 people, it's better. If you keep increasing your sample size, your statistics become better and better at representing
stronger, sure.
trends that
right.
you want to look for. And this is the same thing you'd see. It's why big data is great, right? You're increasing your sample size.
Right. Yes, as you increase that sample size, then you can actually start to recognize things that are truly trends and not just a one-off,
right.
you know,
they're less
event.
Likely to be anomalies.
Yes, exactly.
And
yeah.
this is tracked a lot in, especially in consumer segments. I mean, you know, like every time you buy something on Amazon, it collects a little group of other things that people who have bought that thing have also bought in case you want to buy that thing.
Right.
And can be very useful, not just for that basic, you know, like we want to sell more stuff. But
yeah, I mean,
and with Amazon, sometimes it's creepy how on spot it is, or it's creepy how not on spot it is, and you wonder if there's something you don't know about yourself.
No, my favorite is that if you start to find the products that are on Amazon that have the ridiculous reviews, like the ones that are just, you know, the product itself is absurd for
the
some reason.
The banana slicer or the Bic pens for women.
Or the gallon of milk.
The
right?
gallon of milk,
there,
yeah.
There are examples of products that are on Amazon that people have written like novellas in review, and the novellas are hilarious. Like,
oh, yeah.
You'll get to a point where it's like a soap opera that opens up, and it's this whole thing, and then the last line will be some throwaway review of the product or whatever. And I mean, I love it for the absurdity. What's interesting is that the related items always tend to be the other ones that have similar ridiculous reviews,
because
which means
so
that even then
always tend to include horse mask, horse head mask, you know.
Yeah.
People like you bought this thing.
Right. But at any rate,
I never get that, Joe. That's
I wonder if you click on that, if you also get like The Godfather as a suggestion.
You've seen horse head mask, right?
I've seen horse head mask. Yes.
Yes. Okay.
I've used the internet. So okay. Yes, I have seen it.
Okay.
But yeah, that is another example, right? Amazon uses this in order to make more sales because, the thought is if you are interested in this one particular kind of product, then you're probably interested in these other products, especially if there's a history of other people having bought those together or at least, you know, bought them at some other point in their history.
And then you can start pouring that information not just into what are people going to buy next, but into why are people buying this thing, and start tracking things like flu outbreaks.
Right. Okay. So
this was cool.
This is one of those things that I thought was really an interesting example of using big data in a way that you wouldn't necessarily first think about. This was something that Google wrote up a white paper on. There's actually a full paper about Google using information to detect influenza outbreaks. And the way that they did it was they essentially found search queries that people were putting in that indicated that someone was feeling sick, especially things like various symptoms and stuff. And then by relating that information to specific regions in the world and seeing multiple people requesting this information from, say, a particular city, they could say, this looks like this is an outbreak of the flu. And they said that there was a reporting lag of about 1 day.
Wow.
So a day after a large enough sample size of people are looking for this, Google could say, there's a potential flu outbreak in this very specific area of the world. Maybe we need to, you know, by alerting something like the Center for Disease Control, the CDC, they could say, we need to head this off before it becomes some sort of pandemic.
Right. Which basically says to me that because of Google and big data, we're going to be able to prevent the inevitable zombie
apocalypse. But exactly. The scary thing is we'll probably never even find out about it, right? Because of stuff like this, they'll get to the government before the public knows.
No, there has to be enough queries of dead uncle trying to eat my face for at least a few people to take notice.
And if you happen to be checking Google Trends on dead uncle,
that would trend on Twitter long before.
Yeah. You know, just the Tumblr alone would be
But this
crazy.
Is funny, actually. Google Trends is a great, really simple, really straightforward example of how big data is really interesting.
Yeah.
Like looking at the popularity of a search term over a period of time. I mean, it's so cool. You can get lost in these vortices of
watching the spikes when, you know, different movies or books or cultural events happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like when Kanye West does something embarrassing and immediately shoots to the top.
Yeah.
One I love is when you can look at the historical ones because they have every book ever written, right?
Sure.
They've scanned that in and then they can...
when you say historical ones, I just sit there and think like... Bad play, My American Cousin. I'm thinking like Google Trends throughout the centuries.
No. You can look at like back to 1800 in the books they've scanned, right?
Right, right.
And you can chart changes in spelling, right?
Yeah.
You can compare spelling a word one way versus spelling it another way and watch one go down while the other goes up.
One data artist that I'm going to talk about in a little bit created a graph of the use of hope versus despair. And in recent years, just watching the times when despair overlapped hope.
Interesting.
That's beautiful. I can't wait to talk about that.
Well, and you know,
well, let's talk about some other
applications.
Yeah.
Well, I was going to mention that, you know, when you think about it, Google's mission statement is all about big data because they're about organizing the universe's information, which when you think about that, you know, they want to index and organize all the information everywhere that we ever encounter. That is big data. That's as clear as you can get.
You will be assimilated.
Yeah. And so the fact that they're able to demonstrate the usefulness of this proves that the the utility of their company, mm-hmm. right? Because otherwise, if all they did was index this and there was no actual useful
output,
then you'd be like, well, this company's just not going to stick around. So besides education or predicting a flu outbreak, you can actually use it to monitor cybersecurity and check a network's health. So if you see a spike in network activity, you can check it out and make sure that it's not a DDoS attack, a distributed denial of service attack, so that a hacker hasn't said, hey, this website has raised my ire. I shall direct my zombie computers to attack it. Being able to see that kind of stuff and respond to it in real time is really useful. And you obviously need to have a robust system to deal with a lot of information, because it may just be that it's a heavy amount of traffic for completely legitimate reasons. So that's another implementation of big data.
It's also part of what they're talking about when they talk about the smart grid for electrical companies to be able to get energy to the right places at the right times and prevent brownouts and blackouts, system overloads. People have talked about using tracking the number of UPS packages sent to track how well the economy is doing.
Interesting. Mm. Yeah, I've definitely heard about the smart grid stuff. I mean, there are a lot of utility companies that are running at close to full capacity, and being able to see where a demand is going to be at any given time means that you are reducing the demand on any individual power company, because they can all work in concert together. And that way you don't have you reduce the possibility of a brownout or a blackout. That's clearly important, but that is a lot of information. You're constantly getting feedback from all the different meters, essentially, smart meters. And even if you get down to it, you can have smart appliances that are very specifically giving both you and the network more information about power consumption. So that's also important. Weather forecasting, another important part. Talk about gathering all the information from weather sensors around the world and looking at that information and detecting patterns, because our forecasting abilities, don't know if you noticed.
Oh.
Not so great.
Sometimes it's hilarious, because when you think about it, we have so much power and technology devoted to predicting the weather. And sometimes we're still so
wrong.
It's such a complex system.
The other night, the hourly weather online was telling me 0% chance of precipitation. We had a storm that was knocking limbs out of trees. It was like you couldn't see 10 feet for the rain.
Yeah. And it's hilarious when you take a look and say, wait, they forecast 10 days out? How reliable is that 10th day?
They're 100% wrong about what's happening right now.
Well, and beyond that, you have things like fraud detection, and also governments can use big data for tax collection purposes, looking at trends in taxes and the way that people are paying taxes, and maybe comparing the way people are paying taxes versus what they supposedly owe in taxes, and finding out if there are big gaps there. Because right now, the way it tends to work is it's after the fact, right? People file their taxes, and then a certain number of those tax reports are picked to be looked over in more careful detail, and it's only if they start to detect a pretty significant pattern that they'll look at any individual's taxes specifically, unless you're part of some political controversy, which we won't get into. But this big data thing would allow you to take a look at a much larger scale and focus in on particular problems, as opposed to just hoping that the sheet of reports that you just pulled from the printer includes people who are not paying their fair share.
So I've got a question.
Yeah.
Now that we're talking about the government using big data to predict ne'er-do-wells and...
I think I see where this is going.
Yeah. Y'all seen that movie Minority Report?
The documentary Minority Report? Yes,
yeah.
I have.
Well, okay, so I want to explain a little bit. In that movie, they've got a division of law enforcement called pre-crime.
Right.
Where now in the movie, it's kind of, they've got these like psychic things.
Yeah, precogs.
But let's just say replace the psychics with really, really, really powerful computers.
Right.
That look at trends.
And pattern recognition.
To make extremely accurate predictions about what's about to happen.
Sure.
I can definitely foresee a future where it might not be all that impossible for computers to predict when somebody is very likely to commit a crime.
Well, I can tell you, let me give you a little more insight from my perspective. I don't know that we're going to get to a point where we're going to be able to predict when a specific individual is likely to commit a crime. We can definitely get a little more probabilistic, you know,
right.
Sit there and say, what is the probability of any person at any given time to commit a crime? There are some things that we can say. For example, there are law enforcement agencies out there that are now using big data in order to predict crime trends. So not a specific person, not saying, you know, ne'er-do-well Johnny today is going to knock over the liquor store. Mm-hmm. They are not doing that. What they are doing is saying, looking at this big data, I'm seeing this trend where this particular part of town tends to be a target for vandalization and burglary. Let's say those are two crimes that often...
And there could be tons of factors, you know, based on weather or
light.
Sure. Right.
Though so, apparently things like burglaries kind of go in rashes.
Yeah, that's another thing, is that if a place is hit by burglars, then there tends to be a
increased risk of the same thing happening
in that same general area. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if there's a successful burglary attempt in one particular home, for example, other homes in that neighborhood could be also... prone to being hit by burglars. So that's one example that law enforcement can use. They can use it as a reactionary thing, saying, all right, well, because we know this, we should end up increasing patrols in this area for the time being so that we can discourage any other crime or catch the criminals before they're able to hit another house or another business. Another thing is that for crimes like burglary and vandalism, those are crimes that generally go down when you increase patrols. They are considered low intensity but high frequency crimes. So if you were to adjust patrols so that there is a more frequent patrol of police through that area, you reduce the likelihood of those crimes being committed. And by using big data and really analyzing where these crimes are taking place within a city, you can redraw patrol routes so that police are taking the most efficient patrol they can, so they're not having to patrol an area that's way larger than what they're capable of doing in a given shift. And you also will hit the areas that are most likely to be targeted and help reduce crime that way. You're preventing it from happening. So you're not going out and arresting someone for a crime they haven't committed yet. That's not the same thing at all. But you can help attack those sort of crimes. Things like murder, much less prone to any sort of pattern that you can predict. That's something that's a high intensity but low frequency crime, as opposed to low intensity, high frequency like vandalism and burglary. So they don't tend to take that kind of crime into consideration when they're looking at this big data in this sense, other than to perhaps say that, you know, this particular area of town needs to have a stronger police presence in order to help maintain.
It kind of goes back to what we were talking about with sample size.
Yeah. And like in Santa Cruz, California, police use this approach to identify homes that were more likely to be hit by a burglar so that they could redraw their patrol routes to take that into consideration and prevent that from happening. Now, when we do talk about criminals and the likelihood of someone to commit a particular crime, there is some statistical evidence to suggest that people who have committed a crime are more likely to commit another crime than someone who has never committed a crime. Like there's like a 40% recidivism rate. But part of that is due to the way that we handle criminals and how we try to reintroduce criminals to society. So it may not be that people just have this statistical likelihood of committing a crime again once they've already done so. Some of it's institutionalized.
Oh, right. It's a social construct, not a personal propensity.
Right. So therefore,
well,
you know,
I mean, it wouldn't be the issue what the cause was. It would just be like that you see a trend.
Well, no, there's an issue about what the cause was, because if you can treat the cause, then you remove the percentage.
I'm not saying
you can. Yeah.
I'm saying that criminals matter, and Joe, you're just throwing them away.
I'm talking about what the cause was wouldn't affect how
you
well you could predict it.
Exactly.
It'd just be like, Yeah, you see trends.
I was teasing Joe, but we were very clearly talking about two different things of the same problem.
Yeah, yeah. And what is scary about all of this is the thought that someone could say, well, all of this is reactive in looking for this kind of crime, and why can't we be proactive and getting into that scary minority report
territory? That's what's creepy, yeah.
And that's
sure.
and I think, I mean, I'm not saying that we'll never get to a point where where statistical models won't give at least, again, a probabilistic approach of how likely is person A to commit a crime versus person B. And you take everything into account and you compare that against all the information you've ever gathered and come up with a probability. That's probably going to happen at some point. But I don't think that we're ever going to act on that.
I'm just saying that I think if a computer can predict that Jonathan Strickland is likely to buy a horse head mask, it can also probably predict that Jonathan Strickland is more likely than the average person to rob a Jimmy John's. You know. But
this is terrifying how accurate you are.
But
there's a Jimmy John's within walking distance of this office.
What we should always keep in mind is even if computers are that good, we shouldn't ever let that prejudice our approach to Jonathan Strickland. Because
yes,
he may very well not buy a horse head mask, and he may very well not rob a Jimmy John's.
That's true.
That was my point.
Okay, gotcha. So, yeah, so while Minority Report definitely had this sort of scary science fiction-y approach to, you know, stopping people, arresting people for crimes they had not yet committed but were going to commit, and they, you know, they had the benefit of having psychics who are apparently infallible, except they're not when you watch the movie.
Spoiler.
For a movie that's that old, I'm sorry.
Okay.
Anyone who's listening
it's
to this podcast.
Also based on a Philip K. Dick book
that's
even
really
older.
Yeah. So anyway, I don't think we're ever going to get to a point where big data is
when pre-crime comes up, vote no.
Right.
Write to your representative, say no to pre-crime.
Two things you got to vote no on. Vote no on pre-crime and vote no on giving artificial intelligence the right to vote. Those are the two things you need to make sure.
Big deals.
Yeah. Those are two big strikes.
Okay.
Lauren, can you tell us something happy?
I can. Well, okay. So part of what is scary about all this data is that it's really hard for us to understand what's out there, what we're generating, what it's being used for, and what all that looks like. I mean, because, you know, like we were talking about, like at a certain point, we're like, oh, sure, a quadrillion, what's the number? It's a lot.
2.5 quintillion?
Yeah, it's a one with 15 zeros.
Sorry. That's a lot of zeros.
And that's a lot of zeros. And there are a group of data artists out there. Are you giggling at my
No, I was just thinking, like, that's more than a dozen zeros.
That is more than a dozen zeros. Thank you, Joe.
Let's not let Joe talk anymore. Take the axe away from Joe.
I haven't been touching it. Please go on.
There are a group of data artists out there who are working to put all of this into some kind of meaningful and also culturally meaningful unit that we can process. And there's one particular fellow by the name of Jer Thorpe, who used to be the data artist in residence at the New York Times and has, as of, I think, December or January of 2013, gone off and founded the Office for Creative Research, as it's being called, a company of his. And he posits that this data art is going to help people understand what all of this data means and what it's being used for. And he's got some really interesting, just personal projects. He did a TED talk that's pretty terrific. Or you can see, you know, he's taken Twitter data from people saying good morning and putting it into this kind of gorgeous bouncy map of just tracking when people are waking up and saying good morning to Twitter.
Yeah, wow. He also shows what time they say good morning based upon the color of the block that appears. So if they say good morning earlier, it's a green block. And the later they say good morning,
it goes into the reds.
It goes into the reds. And so he also could show trends that way, like around the world, showing trends of when people would say good morning. And in general, it looks like the West Coast wakes up at around 11 a.m. And the East Coast, we're early risers. Not only because the sun gets to us first, but because the West Coast is sleeping in. It's all those actors who say good morning at 2 p.m.
You're an actor.
That's true. I am, but I get up at, you know, 5 in the morning.
The trick is you don't say good morning.
No.
You're just a grump.
Yeah.
No, you go, coffee.
I hate everyone.
That's pretty much me.
What time do you tweet I hate everyone?
What time? When am I not tweeting that I hate everyone?
All times of day.
So that's an interesting example of data visualization.
Right, right. And that's what they're working for, is that visualization of getting something down to a graphic scale where we can go like, oh, that's still way too huge for me to comprehend, but at least it looks kind of pretty,
right.
And I get it now.
No, yeah. I can totally see that, how that would help people understand what data means.
Yeah. He was talking about in one talk that he gave at PopTech, I believe, about how people have been saying that data is the new oil. And how kind of grandiose and lovely that sounds for a second, because people are thinking like oil is money. Money is good.
Yeah, the world
I'm
runs
an oil,
on oil.
Man.
Yeah.
But at
I'll
the same
drink
time,
your milkshake.
How terrifying that is in a certain way, because oil, for you know, a very specific example, has been a resource that has been so misused and is so poisonous
and
in a certain
caused
way.
Global instability.
And caused terrible global instability and war and all of this. But and that you know, similarly, this data could be used or misused rather for you know, not very good purposes, like we were talking about. But if we, you know, if we use these kind of resources, and by resources I mean people who are processing this, to get away from all of the capitalism, not that capitalism is terrible, but using this data for the greater common good. For the
so things like predicting influenza outbreaks and being able to respond quickly before it becomes a pandemic.
Uh-huh.
I mean, clearly you're talking about benefiting potentially millions of people. I mean, we've seen flu outbreaks affect millions
of course,
people.
And
if you're able to respond fast enough so that you could contain that, then that would be an obvious, you know, benefit to everybody. So yeah, that's just one example. There's some that are more like, well, this makes my life easier, the traffic stuff, for example. But
sure.
even in the bigger scheme, if you talk about traffic, that seems kind of trivial. You know, it means that I don't have to spend, you know, extra time sitting in traffic. That also means you're spending less time running a gasoline powered engine. I mean, unless you have an electric vehicle or whatever, but.
And the stress levels, which relate to your heart rate and health, your productivity at work. If you could get everyone in Atlanta to work in half an hour less than they currently spend on the road, I mean, we would probably just be looking at pictures of cats on the internet anyway. But either way.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree entirely. So there are, and you know, I like the artistic vision of showing this as a way to demonstrate this is just one way of looking at the information, and you know, the ways that you've heard of are just the tip of the iceberg. We haven't even really explored the full extent of what we can use this data for. And in some cases, it may be truly transformative. We won't have to necessarily reinvent or invent brand new technology to make the world a better place. We may have all the tools already. It's just in that information. We have to figure out a way of using
it. Yeah. And part of that is getting people interested in this field and creating a culture around it.
Yeah. Yeah. Agreed. Well, that's awesome. I mean, I've only seen one of those examples. I saw the Good Morning example for Twitter. It was a spinning globe and all the little pop-ups of showing where people had said good morning. It also made me feel better about my tweets because I don't tend to
you
say
don't
good,
tweet
morning.
Good morning.
No, I don't. No, I also don't.
LeVar Burton does. Is LeVar Burton not good enough for you?
No, LeVar Burton is good enough for me. You know, I like to take.
He was
a,
data's
I like to,
best. He was data. That was terrible.
Yeah.
He was data's best friend.
I was about to say, what was
I
the?
I was just the worst Next Generation fan for a second, guys.
Well,
sorry.
Yeah. Okay. So LeVar Burton can say good morning. That's fantastic.
Okay.
I don't. I don't have enough followers to say good morning. I do occasionally quote half of a song lyric. There's a shock, just to see how many people who follow me know what I'm quoting and see
and
who
say
who
the
will.
Rest back. Yeah.
Yeah. So if you know the end of "The Sky is Blue and All the Grass is Green, My Heart's as Full as a Baked Potato," you let me know. All right. Well, I think that wraps up our discussion about applications of big data and what we're using it for. And again, it's just kind of a hint at what big data will be used for. And while, yes, there are certainly examples of how companies, governments could abuse big data in a way that are legitimately scary, there are also some truly amazing uses that could be very beneficial. So I don't think we should shy away from it because of the possibility of things being used in a scary way. We just need to be aware of it and be and make sure that we don't go down that pathway because the benefits are too great for us just to ignore.
Well, of course, it can go either way. I mean, it's elemental. It's knowledge. And yeah. Knowledge is power.
Yeah, it's a tool. And, you know, a tool is it's going to be used the way the person who's using the tool wants to use it. So,
like a drill.
Like a drill.
So nice or so not nice.
You really hammered it home there. We're just going to I'm just going to end here. Guys, if you have suggestions for future episode topics or you want to tell me the end of the song lyric I quoted, write us. Let us know. Our email address is fwthinking@discovery.com or go to fwthinking.com. Check out our blogs. Check out the podcasts. Check out the videos. We've got some really fun ones up there. I think you guys will really like it. And we'll talk to you again really soon.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com. Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.